to kind of introduce you a little bit to, my job's a little simpler because there's not that many coccinellas that really feed on mites, but I also want to talk a little bit about the history of probably the one of the most successful biological control programs of mites that includes a coccinella, and it's probably one that's lasted the longest. So we have actually a couple generations of workers that are working in here between Larry and myself. I actually worked on that when I was a student with Larry. When you're looking at coccinella predators of mites, really, you're really only talking about the genus Stethrus, but there are a number of other species that are known to kind of graze on mostly the spider mites, sometimes rust mites. Epidamia convergens, Ola abdominalis, and some of these other Scimnus species and other things, but they generally don't reproduce on it. It's just generally something that they'll use for an extra supplement to their diet, and they generally don't reproduce on it. When we're looking at coccinella specialist on mites, we're really talking about Stethrus, which is a fairly primitive group. These are obligate specialists, mostly just on spider mites, tetranychids. And they will attack other mites when they're starving, like phytoseid predators. They'll also feed on some rust mites, but they don't do very well on them. They're very geared toward tetranychid mites, and sometimes they don't even do very well on other species of tetranychid mites. They're very much a specialist sometimes to a species or a genus. Now, there have been a number of people that have worked on this over the years, and Putman, he did a lot of work with it, I think it was back in the 60s or 70s, and he could extend adult life with raisins, nectar. I haven't found any real references to pollen. A lot of the early work was before they realized a lot of Stethrus could extend their lives with pollen. But a lot of Stethrus, as I'll show you later on, live over a year long as the adult, so they're very long-lived, and they eat a lot of different things during their lifetime. And they go through periodic extinctions of their prey, and they're very, very good at dispersing to other sites, but they do go through these periods of prey extinctions. And when I first started working on them, I started out training at Michigan State with Fred Stair and Roland Fisher's taxonomist. Like, that's really a coccinella? They kind of look like dermestids to me. They're around. And a lot of growers, these are basically about 1 to 2 millimeters in size. They're not really easy to see, not that easy to see. They all pretty much look like the same thing. Just different colors of the legs and the antenna. They're pretty much all black. They look very similar to Scimnus, and I'm not really sure. I think that's an Asian species, this Talsomia. But they're very different in their biology. It's actually easier to tell the larvae apart. I managed to find some pictures of Stethrus larvae from around the world. The one we have that I'll talk about a lot more later is Stethrus punctum in the USA, which is also Pisces, a different color variation of it. It used to be a separate species. Punctillum has been spread all over the world. But the color variation, the differences in the larvae are actually easier to separate the species than what the adults. The adults, a lot of them, you have to go by genitalic dissections. And when you're looking at the larvae of Scimnus, which the adults look very close to them, they're scale predators for the most part. The larvae are quite different. They have all these waxy extrusions all over them. The pupae are generally a little more brightly colored. The pupae of Stethrus kind of look like small trilobites with hairs all over their backs, and they can build up in very large numbers on the trees. We can get, I've seen as many as a dozen or so on a single apple leaf in Pennsylvania. The eggs of a lot of Stethrus are very also a good distinguishing characteristic. Stethrus punctum generally has a kind of a milky white egg, but other species have various shades of pink and yellow, and almost to the point of being red. Worldwide, I went through some of the economic literature. There's at least 67 species of Stethrus worldwide, so it's a fairly diverse group, and they're pretty much found everywhere. Africa is probably the one area where, well, there's probably a lot of Stethrus there, but there's not that many described from there. Back in 1948, Kapur basically found that there were 27 species, and then there was an explosion of interest in Stethrus as a biological control agent for spider mites around the world. And in, I think it was Gordon in 67, basically 40 species in about 30 years were discovered. And a lot of economic work was done. Elsie Collier in New Zealand and Australia did a lot of the early work, a lot of the early biological work. This was generally before the introduction of broad spectrums. You go back to the literature, you gotta be a bit of a historian because with the introduction of organophosphates and some of the newer pesticides, they went from being very important to almost disappearing overnight. The one exception will be the Stethrus punctum I'm going to talk about in a second. There was a lot of work also in the United States, in Canada, McMurdy, Huffaker, Vandevrie, Colburn, and of course Larry Hall and Gordon in the 70s looking at them as predators, because a lot of the organophosphates and carbamates when they first came out were actually miticidal. So they weren't really a problem, and then they got the resistance, and all of a sudden they came back, and we got to find a new biologic control agent for the tetranychid spider mites. And the case I want to really go through is kind of a historical thing. In the late 60s in Pennsylvania, this is even before Larry's time, wherever Larry is back in here, but there, Dick Colburn and Bob Horsberg, they did a big survey in Pennsylvania because mites were becoming an increasingly more of a problem. They looked at dozens of different groups of potential predators out there, and they actually found that the Stethrus punctum was probably the most efficient and the most abundant one there. There was a lot of work early done. I don't know how to use this mouse, but a lot of the true bugs, the Hemipteran myriads and stuff that they found at that time were actually very, very effective, but they only had one or two generations a year, so they weren't very well synchronized with the tetranychid mite prey, whereas Stethrus had lots of generations. They dispersed very quickly, and they were very voracious. The predatory mites we had at the time were the Phytoceas and the Stigmaeas were not terribly effective because at that point they hadn't really developed resistance to most of the new insecticides. Now the pest that we have mostly in our apple system in Pennsylvania and the Mid-Atlantic region is European red mite, which is a periodic problem pretty much all season long. We also have two-spotted spider mite, which is less of a problem. It's more of a problem in seasons where we have real dry weather. They move up from the weeds and the grass and they get into the tree later in the season. And then we also have a number of urified rust mites, which if we're depending on predatory mites, we kind of consider them to be food. You have to have like 300 or 400 per leaf before you even get too excited about them. But fresh market guys, especially as we're getting to things like Honeycrisp and really susceptible varieties on small rootstocks, get worried about them because they affect the color and they'll russet the fruit. So there's a real marketing problem with those. But generally we can pretty much ignore them. They usually don't build up unless we're using pyrethroids or something. Now the damage from the mites is basically what we call bronzing. Anybody that's worked on mites, I mean, they're sucking the chlorophyll out of the leaves. The plant will take on a yellowish color, and an apple tree, this is an apple tree in the middle of the season, it looks like it's been hit by frost in the fall. And when you get 20 to 30 mites per leaf on there, that's when you get that damage. Basically what it does is reduce the fruit quality at the end of the season, the color, which is important for marketing on different varieties, the size, and the thing that a lot of growers really worry about is the return bloom, because it sucks the carbohydrate reserves out of the plant, and they set their fruit crop for the next season, and you'll have a very small return bloom. And then the other big concern, especially once we got to this initial phase of a lot of the new insecticides being miticides, is that mites get resistance at a rate that almost all the other predators and beneficials have never been able to match. And they're very expensive. This could cost up to a third of the total insecticide budget of an apple grower in Pennsylvania back at that time. Now Larry did a lot of work with Betsy Beers, and there's been a lot of work with other workers, basically looking at what kind of tolerance, what levels of mites can we tolerate, which also, is, as you find out, is important for what predators we need out there. And basically they found that earlier in the season, unfortunately the mouse not working, early in the season, like May to June, you can only tolerate 2.5 mites per leaf. When you got later in the season, the trees got a little bit further along and a little bit more developed, you could tolerate about 5 mites per leaf, and then after middle of July, you can tolerate 7 mites per leaf. Well, this kind of separates out the different predators because some of them can only exist at very high prey levels. Now, Stethrus, there's been a lot of intensive work done on this. I got into the program more toward the end of it when we were looking at developing selective insecticides to keep Stethrus going. But a lot of the biology, and I assume this is probably very similar to a lot of those other 67 species of Stethrus worldwide, they required 5 mites per leaf just to stay in the orchard. So if this happened when red mites were out there in the middle of the season, the grower would already be spraying a miticide trying to knock them out because the economic threshold had already been reached. And they basically, to actually start reproducing, they needed 8 to 10 mites per leaf, which if you remember that table I had here a second ago, the highest level for an economic threshold was 7.5. So often you got some damage with Stethrus before they brought the populations under control. And they were very voracious. I mean, the adults could eat up to 9 of these spider mites per hour, and 75 to 100 per day. The total number that the larvae could eat during their period was very long. And you got to remember, the adult Stethrus are living a year, and I think Putnam actually kept them going in the lab for up to 2 years as the adults. Now, the development is very quick. That was a nice advantage over a lot of the myriad bugs, is that you went from an egg to an adult in normal Pennsylvania conditions in about 23 days. So we'd have about 3 generations a year. These things fly very well. They kind of, as I'll show you in a second, they cue in on the yellow color. So they would go to where the damage was. And let's see, total fecundity was much greater. Actually, if you looked at the number of eggs, they could actually out-reproduce the, on an individual basis, the spider mites. Some of our stigmaids and phytoseid mites actually are lag behind on reproduction from the pests that they're trying to control. A lot of the biology was basically looking at where are they coming from. Well, we know a lot of them come from outside of the orchards. They fly in and they feed on mites out on in woodlots and trees. But within the orchard, we found that a large percentage of them were actually reproducing. They would overwinter as adults down in the ground cover close to the tree, move back up early in the spring, find patches of mites, and then redistribute themselves to wherever the hot spots were within the orchards. They generally enter diapause after the average daily temperature is reached around 10 degrees, emerge in the spring after the average daily temperatures were at least 10 degrees Celsius. And it was basically about 100 to 300 degree days at base 5. That's the standard base temperature I've seen for a lot of different Stethra species after March 1st. And this basically, you know, we could time our sprays, figure out which things we're going to try and impact them. At the half-inch green stage in apples, this is basically, they were just getting started. By pink, about half of them had emerged. And by petal fall, most of them were off out of the ground cover and working on the tree and dispersing to the hot spots. And I just put a few papers in here that we had actually published a number of these papers on. We also found that they're very strongly attracted to yellow sticky traps. And this makes sense because they're going to those yellow trees where they would find the mites. We also think there's a volatile component that's attractive to them as well. We tried ammonium carbonate, which is a bait that they use for apple maggot and cherry fruit flies and things like that. And it seemed like there was a little bit of an interaction there, but the color was actually most important. And for some reason, when you put white sticky traps out there with the volatile, they actually seem to repel them for whatever reason. It's something that probably should be looked at again. Larry did a lot of work when he was a student looking at the predator-prey ratios and ways for growers to actually scout the program, basically looking for the pest mites, and then time counts of the Stethras to try to kind of come up with a decision aid for growers whether or not they needed to spray for miticides. And basically what it came down to, you look at so many leaves on there, you would translate the presence or absence of the mites into a mites per leaf number, and then you would do a 3-minute count around the tree, counting Stethras adults and larvae, and then you looked at the ratio of those two, and if the ratio of Stethras to mites was 2.5 or higher, you didn't have to spray a miticide. There was a lot of cases when you did, or you had to try and spray something that was more selective. Now the period in the, I guess probably from the 80s to the early 90s was this period when there was a lot of sprays out there for leaf rollers, and there was growers are kind of walking this tightrope trying to balance between controlling leaf rollers, which were getting resistance to everything, and they were using higher rates of pyrethroids, carbamates, which are very toxic to Stethras, and if they went too far that way, then they lost their mite control. And the method they came up with, this actually started out as a fungicide type thing, is they went to these ulnaromittal sprays, which is probably the reason why Stethras was successful in Pennsylvania and the Mid-Atlantic regions over the rest of the world. We used toxic compounds in an ecologically selective way. We would go through and have the growers would spray one side of the tree, and then 7 days later come back and spray the other side. Well, Stethras was so mobile, and the dosage actually on the other side of the tree was only about 20% of the dose, it selected for resistance in Stethras. And we got very high levels of euthyrin and some of the other insecticide resistance, and we didn't completely exterminate them from the orchard. We allowed the adults to either move away from the residues or some of them to survive on the opposite side of the tree. And that's probably the only reason why we were able to survive with Stethras when a lot of the countries like Australia, New Zealand, and some of the South American countries basically, when the broad-spectrum insecticides came in, Stethras disappeared. And it's interesting now, as we're getting to more physiologically selective compounds, I'm getting a lot more requests for reprints because Stethras is starting to appear back into the New Zealand, Australian, and some of the, especially in India, I get a lot of requests. Okay, Stethras, basically the problem with that was that there was a lot of bronzing. Like I said, the thresholds were high enough that you had some injury. Growers were willing to tolerate that at the time because we didn't have terribly effective miticides. There were miticides that, like Kelthane and Plictran, that they had gotten resistance to, and there really was no alternative. The industry wasn't churning out a bunch of new miticides every year, so that was the only game in town, and they were mostly processing at that time, too. Which processing apples, you really don't care about the russeting on the surface of the fruit or color like that. You could tolerate a bit of damage, and the industry in Pennsylvania and the Mid-Atlantic at that time was about 70 or 80% processing. Fresh market guys, they were a lot more sensitive to it. So it fit really well into the type of programs that we had. And what was it a success? Well, from Ed Rejon and Larry got some numbers together back a number of years ago, and they basically figured from the late to early 80s to the 1990s that it reduced miticide use by about 50% in Pennsylvania, just in Pennsylvania alone. And this is really true of all the other acreage in the Mid-Atlantic as well. Everybody pretty much adopted it. And it saved growers about a little over $1 million a year, about $20 million over that 15-year period. And the really striking thing was that this was in a time period when you're using kelthane at 4 to 5 pounds per acre in Plictran. They saved 2.2 million pounds of miticides, what the estimate was. So it was a very successful program. Well, I did my work on selective insecticides when I was with Larry, but I went to work for Roman Haas for a while, the evil chemical industry, but I was working on selective insecticides. When I came back, I started, and when I was working with them, I was doing a lot of work in apple orchards. We started to see a kind of a mysterious decline in numbers of stethrus, probably about the mid-90s. And we started seeing some increases in some of the other predators, such as the phytoseed mites. And this is some old pictures of Larry and I actually in the lab there, but we did a lot of assays both when I was there and when I was with Roman Haas looking at the selective insecticides on stethrus. And we think we've kind of linked, and this was published in one of those papers there too, we found that a lot of these so-called selective insecticides, the reduced risk pesticides, are actually very toxic to stethrus, much more so than the azofos methyl and some of the other products that we kind of conditioned with the aldermanol sprays. The neonicotinoids, imidacloprid especially, was murder on them. A lot of the chitin synthesis inhibitor IGRs, Novaluron being one now, is very strongly ovicidal to them. And a lot of other countries saw this as well. It also kills them from the larval to the pupil mold. Juvenile hormone analog, same thing. These so-called selective compounds were very, very disruptive to stethrus and some of the new miticides that came along. And also we had a switch in the industry from away from processing apples with big old trees to little small fresh market apples that didn't have the tolerance for the damage anymore. So it was actually about 4 years ago when we started noticing that stethrus was disappearing and growers were nuking all the orchards again with miticides, that we started looking for another predator. And I was doing a research in a number of orchards we called reduced risk from a RAMP grant that we had. And we were seeing increased numbers of phytoseeds. And we had one grower that basically used to rely on stethrus, but now was relying, he wasn't spraying anything. We found high numbers of what we thought were Amblyopsis foliaceus, a phytoseed. And what it turned out to be is actually we had T. pyrae move in from New York and New England for the first time. There had been multiple surveys in the past and they never found it. And T. pyrae has basically replaced stethrus because it's pretty much resistant to all these so-called reduced risk insecticides. It tolerates the neonicotinoids and all the IGRs, and actually is a much more effective predator in the long run than what stethrus was. These are some of the surveys looking at T. pyrae. It was a bit of a surprise. We thought we were too hot, kind of at the southern range of it. But T. pyrae now, it looks like it changed the fonts a little bit. But basically, growers in about 2005 were putting on about 2,200 pounds of miticide AI on the 22,000 or 23,000 acres of apples in Pennsylvania. And this was costing growers about $700,000 to $800,000 a year. And they were putting on 35,000 gallons of dormant oil, which is getting really expensive, and you really don't want going out in the environment. And by switching to T. pyrae, which we've got going now, that cost is down to only $50,000 a year, and we're saving most of that miticide and the oil. The point we're at right now is that we have T. pyrae very well established as a predator in there. We only need one of those to every 10 pest mites. But they do their best job early in the spring or late in the fall. They don't handle the summer heat. So when they get out of control, say two spotted mites move up into the trees, we still rely on stethrus to kind of move in there. Now stethrus is kind of a secondary role. It's supplementing our biological control with the phytoseeds, but it's still out there and important. And then we're making plans to get away from some of these other toxic IGRs that are impacting. So the reason that T. pyrae became so important in Pennsylvania was basically that we had the selection pressure in apples of about 45, 50 years of euthyam. That basically, and we did it, we applied it in an ecologically selective way, which other countries didn't do, and we built up the resistance. And the pattern resistance was that we were able to use euthyam for 55 years or whatever because cowlick moth didn't get resistance to it. So the main pest we're trying to knock out is cowlick moth, and we can still use glutathione for it, but the secondary pest got resistance. We needed the biological control to take them out, and we had a resistant biological control organism. And then this aldermanol plays a very strong part. When we didn't have physiologically selective compounds, we used toxic compounds in a selective manner. Now we have selective compounds. We need to figure out how selective they are. but they're changing the whole system. So that's about a 40-year picture of what the program was going on in Pennsylvania. Thank you.